Welcome to the debut of Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill, Maine, and at WERU.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. The life of the arts is a test of the quality of a nation's civilization, said JFK. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's show, we will chat with four wonderful guests: Helen Daly, a cross-stitcher and floss tuber; Dr. Philip Edelman, Bangor Band music director and director of the University of Maine School of Performing Arts; and Molly Cashwell and Ikhlas Ahmed from the Cultural Alliance of Maine. For our first guest, we have Helen Daly. Welcome, Helen. And thank you for joining us on Creative Maine. Helen is a floss tuber from Topsom, Maine, and is here to answer the burning question: what in the world is a floss tube? So, Helen, maybe you can start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you come to be in Topsom and a floss tuber.
Thank you, Adina. I am originally from Maine. I grew up in West Gardner from a very crafty family. My parents, not my dad so much, but my mom and both of my grandmothers were all very crafty. So crafts were something that my sister and I always did. And the one that really stuck with me was cross stitch. So a floss tuber is someone who cross stitches and films videos that they put on YouTube. And they kind of call our little segment of YouTube is floss tube, because cross stitch uses embroidery floss, and that's where the name came from.
That's amazing. So I've heard also of quilty tube, which I guess is self-explanatory.
And book tube.
Oh, okay. So YouTube is the platform for all sorts of crafty information and endeavors. And I know a lot of people find floss tubes highly entertaining. How did you discover floss tube? How did you come? I believe you have a channel, do you not?
I do. I do have a channel. Mine is not very creatively named. It is simply Helen D, because at the time I made it, I couldn't get YouTube to accept any creative names. So that's what I went with.
There you go.
I may just get it done kind of girl. I had always cross-stitched since I was very young. And then you kind of, you know, you might get out of it when you're in college and recently married and have kids. But I got to the point where I had gotten done my job and I was a stay-at-home mom and I was looking for something to do. And I needed to, I wanted to do something with my hands. So I went back to cross stitch kind of in a bigger way. And I joined a couple of Facebook groups. And on those Facebook groups, people would talk about floss tube. And, oh, I was watching so-and-so. And did you see this pattern that they were stitching, or the way that they finished this piece? And I thought, well, floss tube, I don't even know what this is. So I kind of just Googled and went on YouTube and found some of the people that other people were talking about and started watching some videos. And it really is people talking about cross stitch, which may not seem like something that someone would want to watch. But if you are a cross stitcher, you're very interested in watching what other people are doing and seeing different patterns that people are stitching and different colorways that they're changing things and how they're finishing. So that's kind of how I got exposed to Flosstube. And then I probably watched a good year, year and a half before I thought, well, I could do that. Why not? I'll put myself out there and maybe 10 people will watch, maybe no one will watch. And over the years, my channel has grown. I think a lot of channels have grown as more and more people have found the craft or come back to it. So that's kind of how I got started on Flosstube.
When do you think, when would you estimate that FlossTube became a thing? When did FlossTube come to be? Do you
I
know?
think I started in, I believe it was 2017, and it had already been going on a good 5 years. I think it was a slow build. And then I think, especially in 2020, when everything closed and the pandemic came, a lot of people had more time to do things and turned to creative things. People discovered cross stitch for the first time. People came back to cross stitch. And then, just like me, they joined a Facebook page or they followed someone on Instagram and heard this term Flosstube. And then they found Flosstube, and then more and more people started making their own videos.
Well, you have a background in media, do you not?
I do. Yep. I was a television news producer for 14 years. So I was on the other side of the camera. But because I think I had done that, it didn't, I wasn't nervous really about being on camera because that was just something I dealt with every day.
Wow. And it's probably evolved. You mentioned the pandemic, and I know that a lot of creative endeavors exploded during the
Absolutely.
pandemic.
Yep,
And
absolutely. I think a lot of people, you hear people say that that's when they either first discovered cross stitch or came back to it after a long time and discovered that it wasn't teddy bears and geese and things stitched in blue and mauve, and a kit that you could get at a department store, right? There's such a larger collection of designers putting out new charts. Things have gotten very modern if you're into that. If you're not into that, there's literally something for everyone in cross stitch. You just have to look around and find your style.
So, do you think that FlossTube serves to signal boost these designers and their patterns and other crafty
I think so,
people?
because I think a lot of times you'll hear people on FlossTube talk about being enabled or being an enabler, because if you see someone stitching something, you might think, oh, I really like that chart, or oh, that's a new designer to me. I'm going to look and see what else they have, because if I like this one, maybe I'll like their other designs as well. So I think it really does give people a chance to see something. And cross stitch is one of those crafts that when you see a design, it's very two-dimensional, it's a picture. People always say that what really sells a piece is seeing it in person. And we're not able to go to a store that might have, walls and walls and walls and walls and walls of cross stitch. But through FlossTube, you see things in a more three-dimensional way. You see someone working on it, you see the colors and the fabrics, and it really kind of brings everything to life.
So what has FlossTube meant, especially to the cross stitch community in Maine? I think cross stitch is pretty organized in Maine relative to other states.
I think it is. And I know when I started my channel, I knew my sister also cross stitched. And I had a friend from college who lived in New Hampshire that cross stitched, but I didn't really know any other stitchers. And through FlossTube, I've met all kinds of friends that cross stitch. And then I think people that watch hear someone else say, oh, I got together with a group of stitchers at a coffee shop. And we just put the word out there that, hey, we're going to meet at this coffee shop Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Come join us. And that spurred people to say, well, I could get together with some friends at a coffee shop. So that way they were able to kind of set up their own meetings and connect with stitchers that way. And I think there's several groups now in Maine that get together that way. And there have been different retreats, a cross stitch retreat that you can go to. And now we actually have an online store in Maine and two brick and mortar stores in Maine that are new since one of the brick and mortar stores just opened 2 months ago. So it's really helped expand the industry here in Maine and
Okay.
connect Maine stitchers with other stitchers.
That's amazing. How can our listeners get involved in these craft specific YouTube communities? How does that work?
I think one great resource for anyone in Maine is a Facebook group. It's called Vacation Land Stitchers. And it is run by a woman named Michelle out of Maine. And she keeps up to date with when different events are scheduled and always keeps a post of, hey, there's a group getting together in Biddeford this weekend or in Augusta or in Bangor, because they're all over the state. So that is a great first spot is Vacation Land Stitchers. That way you can kind of meet up with other Maine stitchers. And
Can you find out about retreats that way?
you can find absolutely, you can find out about retreats that way. And you
Can you
can
briefly describe a retreat?
a retreat, a cross stitch retreat is people think, what on earth is this? It is really just a day or a couple of days, depending on the retreat, that you get together all in one place and you sit and you stitch and you talk. Sometimes you just talk and you might leave and think, I thought I was going to stitch all day, but I put in 30 stitches. But what I did do was talk and meet all these other Maine or local or regional, wherever you happen to be, where you meet all these other stitchers and you walk around and you see everyone else's work and how beautiful it is. And you really get to hear how passionate they are about what they're working on. There are different kinds of cross stitches that appeal to different people. One of the big kinds is your traditional samplers with alphabets and floral motifs and numbers. And some people absolutely love stitching them. They don't appeal to me per se, but I can appreciate everyone else's love for them. They're beautiful. So no matter what you're stitching, it may not be something that really is right up your alley, but you still appreciate the work that goes into it. And it's just nice to see those things in person and talk to people about what they're
Oh, sounds like a whale of a good time.
doing.
So, tell us about something that is coming up pretty soon. Are there some meetups or retreats or things that are listeners can get involved in the near term.
Like I said, Vacation Land Stitchers keeps up to date on the kind of bi-weekly, once a month meetups at different coffee shops throughout the state. But then there's also, this will be the third year of a retreat going on in the summer called Stitch Maine. And it's a 1 day, 9 to 5 retreat. It's held in Hallwell. And that one, the date has not been released quite yet, but more information is coming and it will be posted on Vacation Land Stitchers when that comes out. That's a great kind of first place. I'll also have the details. Like I said, I have my floss tube channel is Helen D, and I'll have details on that because I don't run that. It's run by Penny, who owns the dailystitcher.com, which is a great online shop in Maine. But I kind of help organize with her. So we'll put that on this summer. This will be our third year. There's a retreat happening in April. That one is currently sold out, but hopefully it will be something that happens again and again. And that one is happening in Augusta. So they're kind of all over. There's Lakeside Needlecraft. There's a new store in Greenville. And they've been having some different retreats. So you kind of just look around and they are out there. And countless times I've heard from people, I thought I was the only stitcher in Maine. You're not. We're here. We just have to find each other and connect.
And I'm sure that if someone
doesn't cross stitch yet, but might like to, I'm sure any of these resources will be there to help you.
Oh, there's no better place than a room full of stitchers when you want advice about stitching. I had a friend reach out, a mom friend that you know through school, and she messaged me on Facebook and she said, this is going to be an odd question, but I'm looking to get back into cross stitch and didn't know if you might have any ideas of where to start. It's like, oh, you've come to the right place.
Do I ever? Yes. So, what are some highlights coming to your channel, to the Helen D channel?
Let's see. I usually do kind of a twice a month, bi-weekly updates that just kind of show what I've been working on the last 2 weeks. One thing that I've kind of gotten known for on my channel is I do a lot of tutorials showing how to take a piece that you stitched and turn it into something, whether it be a pillow or framing or whatever you want to do with it. I also am having the opportunity to go to the Nashville Needlework Market, which is a wholesale event that happens in Tennessee. And it's something that usually just stores go to. And all the stores go to one place and they do all kinds of shopping and then they go back to their home states and do all kinds of selling.
Oh.
So it's nice and fun. And I have a friend who is a designer. So I go and help her in her room, kind of her booth, selling her wares.
Talk
So,
about enabling, my
yeah,
goodness.
absolutely. My suitcase will be heavier on my way home.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on our channel. I really appreciate it for you being on Creative Maine, WERU 89.9 FM. Thank you so very much, Helen. I appreciate it so very much.
Thank you, Adina.
All right. Well, here we are changing gears a little bit from the craft world to the music world. And I want to welcome our guest, Dr. Philip Edelman from the University of Maine. Welcome, Phil. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
And for full transparency, I am a proud and happy member of the Bangor Band, which Dr. Edelman is the conductor of. So just bringing that out. So can I ask you a little bit about how you got to where you are? You're the director of the School of Performing Arts at the University of Maine.
That's right.
And
Yep.
right. And in addition to that, if we're talking about town and gown, you've got them both going on. So please talk to us a little bit about your background and how you got where you are.
Sure. Well, I grew up in a school system that valued music education quite highly, and so I had an excellent early sort of exposure to music, and I got to play, and I got to sing, and I got to do everything. I had excellent teachers all through public school, and then after I graduated high school, I decided that this is what I wanted to do with my life. So I went to the University of New Hampshire for my undergraduate degree. And then I flew to the middle of the country and decided to do a master's degree at Kansas State University. And that was a wind conducting and music education degree. And then I taught for a number of years in the suburbs of Wichita, Kansas. Decided that it was time to move on to higher education and do a PhD at the Conservatory of Music in Kansas City. And now I'm at the University of Maine. It's been
Awesome.
a long and fabulous road.
All right. So, what do you play actually? What is your instrument?
My very first sort of primary instrument is the tuba, but nowadays I play more piano than anything else. But here at the university, prior to becoming the director, I also taught our undergraduate methods courses in woodwinds and brass. So I taught trumpet, horn, trombone, euphonium, tuba, flute, saxophone, clarinet, oboe, bassoon.
What do they call a musical equivalent of a polyglot? That would be you.
Band director.
Band director. Exactly. Well, I want to get back to the community aspect and growing up in a good school system. I'm going to get back to that in a moment, but how did you get involved in the community band aspect of your career?
Sure. When I was in the middle of my PhD program in Kansas City, we had a community band called the New Horizons Band. They worked out of a community center on the Kansas side of the state line. And one of the great things about that institution was that the undergraduate students at that institution also acted as teachers for the folks that were in that band. The New Horizons movement itself is dedicated to either a second entry point for people who never had the opportunity to learn an instrument to play in a band. So you didn't play in your high school band and you're, 50 years old now, you're winding down your career, or your children have moved out of the home and you're looking for something to do. That's what the organization is dedicated to. So we take people from beginning level to professionals. And everything in between. So it's not uncommon to hear stories like, oh, I played trumpet in my high school band and I loved it, but then, I got my degree in nuclear, whatever, and had my career, put down my trumpet, and now 50 years later, I'd like to pick it back up again. And so that's what we're here for.
So really, in some ways, a community ensemble, whether it's a band or a choir even, can we can say that it's actually an educational institution in some fashion.
Oh, I'd say, yeah, if you're not learning, you shouldn't be there. It's probably not worth your time.
Yes. That's right. And so it fits in very closely with community education. Now, I know that a lot of members of the Bangor Band are educators themselves, are music educators, and you train music educators for the state of Maine.
I
So
do.
yeah, so it's so circling back to the importance of being in a school band in your life, when you get to the University of Maine and you see this training program, how does the Bangor Band and ensembles like it? I know there's many. There's one in Ellsworth, and they're all over the state. How do we bring that back into the classroom somehow? Where do you or bring the classroom to it? Where do you see education fitting in the overall scheme?
It depends on the model of each individual band. Some bands are really open to having undergraduates sit in on secondary instruments. Some are not. Some are open to having undergraduate students come in and give lessons to people who are a little bit rusty. Some are not. In our band, because of the level at which we play right now, it would not be appropriate necessarily for someone who's never played a clarinet before to show up and play a clarinet. But at the University of Maine, if someone wanted to, if their goal was to join the Bangor Band and they hadn't played their kazoo in 60 years, we could set them up with one of our undergraduates who's a kazoo major or a clarinet major or a trumpet major or whatever, some lessons under their belt. And then when they felt comfortable to join the band, we would welcome them into the band.
There's a scholarship program too, is there not, for young people?
From the Bangor Band, there is. Yeah. If you're a young person in the Bangor Band, well, if you're any age and you're pursuing an undergraduate degree, the Bangor Band does have two scholarships available, and just to help set offset some of the cost of that education.
What I found interesting too in the makeup of the band, I mentioned that a lot of our members are teachers who were in their day members of the Bangor Band before or during college, which is a
Sure.
wonderful continuum.
Yeah. We have, I mean, in any community band, if it's done well, and that's my bias, but my personal philosophy is that you don't have to be a certain age to be a strong contributor to a community ensemble. So you should see that music spans the lifetime. As an example, in Bangor Band, we have had sixth and seventh graders in there. And we have a member who's well over 90 right now, so it's not only do we all learn from each other within that specific setting, but the message that music is a truly lifelong pursuit, is a powerful one, and it's one that I will evangelize every chance that I get.
Yeah, I know that we as a band will do a concert for the school music youth camp.
Yep, MSYM, the Maine Summer Youth Music Camp. Yep.
There you go. And usually as an introduction, we say, how many people have been playing their instrument for more than 60 years, 50 years, 40 years? And it's amazing how many people have been doing it since, more than 50 years. It's quite astonishing. So, do you feel community bands played a part in these teachers' career choices?
I don't have any research on that, but what I will say is these community bands play a large part in keeping our teachers who are members of the band sort of centered and making music for themselves. As a music, as a public school music teacher, you are everything to everybody, and you spend your entire day filling out forms and fixing instruments and, making sure that the bus list is ready to go to the state jazz festival or whatever it is that you do. And, what we tell our students here is about 20% of your day is spent actually making music, which, for someone who decides that they want to be a music educator, that's too small of a percentage of their day to really keep them passionate about the subject matter. So I think what you see is a lot of professional music educators join these types of ensembles to get that musical fulfillment that they're getting some of during their day, but most of our day as music educators isn't actually spent making music. It's spent, doing the other stuff that makes the 20% of our day of making music actually work.
The administrivia of it
Yeah,
all.
it's not a
Absolutely.
small portion of the job.
No, as any teacher, but especially a music teacher. So I think that the intergenerational aspect of the band, combined with how we're engendering that passion or keeping that passion alive for music professionals, is huge. Bringing it back to the value of a band to bring it back to its town is what I'm trying to say. So we've affected the place where we live. We've affected Bangor and the surrounding areas for that reason. But let's talk about the audience for a second, because I'd say that one of the, I would argue that one of the biggest participants in a community ensemble experience is our audience.
Oh, for sure. And we've got, and it's not just us. You go to a community band up in Presque Isle, you go to a community band down in Castine, you go to a community band out in Farmington. There are people who have been going to those concerts for 30, 40, 50 years because they love it, and it's a consistent part of the town's personality. It's a consistent experience that one can pass on to their children. And that's one of the reasons, for example, with Bangor Band, you see that we're programming a little bit more what I might call family-friendly music. We're trying to reach out to younger audiences to start getting them interested. One of the ideas that me and my colleague Scott Burdett, who's our fabulous assistant conductor, associate conductor in the Bangor Band, we've been talking about is having a dedicated children's concert where we have an instrument petting zoo set up for second, third, fourth, fifth graders to look at these instruments, put their hands on these instruments, learn from the members of our ensemble about these instruments before they have to commit to an instrument at their school. And, we're playing more Disney music and things like that to really try to keep it interesting for everybody.
That's a wonderful idea, actually. So our ensemble and most community ensembles offer free concerts, which I think is a very important part of the model, nationwide. So, how, aside from showing up at the concerts, how can our listeners support these bands otherwise?
Well, there's always costs incurred with these ensembles. Things break, music needs to be purchased. There are some community bands around the country that have, huge endowments, so they don't need to charge admission or anything like that. We're sort of in that middle area where we don't charge admission, but we take donations. All that helps, especially to keep people playing who might otherwise not have the ability to play due to the cost it incurs. It's predictable. If you play clarinet, you're going to be spending, a couple $100 every few years just on upkeep of your instrument. For some members of our ensemble, that's no big deal. And for some members of our ensemble, that's a huge deal. And so,
Yes.
we don't charge membership fees like some other community ensembles. So any of those expenses that come up, especially in the ensemble-owned instruments like percussion equipment or that sort of thing, we have to find that money somewhere. So those donations really do help. We don't pocket them or anything like that.
Okay. So how can a listener in Maine become involved in a musical ensemble, even if they haven't played their instrument in 30 years? What would you suggest?
I would suggest getting in touch with your local school music teacher who will know what's around you. And if you don't know who your local school music teacher is, go to the UMaine website, type in Edelman, click on the picture of my head, and email me, and I will find you an ensemble.
All right, that's awesome. How about people who have never played an instrument? I think there's singing ensembles. Everybody can sing. We got that instrument right in us.
Absolutely. There are community choirs, there are community orchestras. Maine has a really rich history of all of these sorts of things. And so I think your listeners might be surprised to know just how many different opportunities there are in Maine. If you're a true novice and you've never played or sung in an organized fashion before, there will be opportunities for you. We just might have to look a little harder.
All right. Well, that's a wonderful thing. And I appreciate your time. We enjoyed talking to you about musical opportunities in Maine and the community ensemble model. I think that's wonderful. If you have any questions for us about this topic, you can either go to Dr. Edelman's website and click on his head, as he mentioned, or you can go to weru.org and click on Creative Maine and Info and ask your question on an email. Very glad to have you do that. So thank you so much. I appreciate your time and your expertise, and I look forward to more great music in Maine.
Anytime. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. So now we welcome our two last guests of the episode, Molly Cashwell and Ikhlas Ahmed. And Molly is the Director of Policy and Operation for Cultural Alliance of Maine. And Ikhlas is Director of Community Engagement for Cultural Alliance of Maine. So welcome, ladies, to our program.
Hi. Thanks
And
for having
I'd like to ask you both a little bit about each of you because you're running this organization together and you're going to explain it to us, but you live in different places and so forth. So tell me, how does that all work? And how did you come to this place in life? Molly, why don't you jump in?
Yeah, sure. So I work out of Ellsworth and live near Ellsworth now, but I grew up in the Bangor area primarily. So I guess you could say I'm sort of Eastern Maine based. I was born in Calais, so it kind of extends into Washington County too, my network. And so with Ikhlas having lived in the Portland area for a decade and a half or so, a long time. It just makes sense for a state like Maine to have this kind of dual staff structure, at least we think, when we're trying to unite such a wide-ranging sector, like the cultural sector, which extends into very small towns, is in obviously our biggest towns and cities as well in Maine. We just feel like, the opportunity to be on the ground and participating in cultural communities in different regions of Maine brings a lot of strength to our perspective and the way that we operate.
Okay. Ikhlas, how about you?
Thank you for having us. My name is Ikhlas Ahmed, and I was really excited that the pioneers or the people that came together around our state to bring CAM to what it is today, to the Cultural Alliance of Maine to be an art and advocacy art organization. I am someone who has lived in Maine for a long time, but I'm originally from Sudan. My family had to leave my country due to the ongoing genocide and current war that's happening in our home country of Sudan. My family was resettled in Portland, Maine, around 2006, 2007, and have lived here for a long time, regardless of how many times I try to escape Maine, the snow, the constructions, the diversity of Maine. I've tried to escape many times, but realized that my heart is just rooted here, because of how many beautiful people I have encountered, people that are working really hard to make Maine a better place for all of us to live in. So I've worked, my background is in education, and I've worked with administration, teachers, and parents and students. So I've had the opportunity to kind of meet a lot of Mainers, and when the idea of CAME came along to continue this community engagement and bringing people together to brainstorm on a bigger scale, not just where I live in Portland or nearby, but for the whole state, I really was really driven for that purpose in bringing us together in one space. And how can we strategize and make sure that we're working to just better our state and our communities?
That's wonderful. So this leads me to the question, what is CAM actually? And we know it's the Cultural Alliance of Maine, but what is that? And what is its origin story?
Yeah, so as Ikhlas mentioned, there was a group of people almost, well, 4 years ago now, which is hard to believe that that's actually when COVID happened, 4 years ago this month, practically. There was a realization that many industries have, for many decades, had their representation in Augusta, or have had alliances or networks that helped them stay connected and in communication and in community with one another, forestry or fishery or the hospitality sector. I mean, just so many. And the cultural sector didn't have an umbrella organization that could really unite an industry that, ranges from libraries to the arts, to theaters, to historic buildings and historic preservation efforts. I mean, there's incredible organizations that are, dedicated to advancing those fields. But, in terms of being able to unite all of us and unite our voices to have a bigger presence around the table, so to speak, where policies are being made, it was realized that an organization needs to be formed that is dedicated to advocacy, to community building, to research, to understand the sector more. Most other states in the country have had something like this for quite a while, and Maine just, it has not really been feasible to do that here. So the onset of Zoom at about this time obviously was really a game changer. We have conversations with people in York County, in Fort Kent, in Western Maine, in Bethel, Eastport, and that's realistically possible now for us to bring people together to exchange ideas, commiserate about challenges, and help solve them together. And overall, just to develop or to achieve alignment about what we need to change in the state and what we need to build together, so that we can continue to change Mainers' lives every day in a more effective way and get support to do so.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful and very necessary kind of organization. Do you, I heard you say you work on advocacy. I assume at the state house level, is that what you're saying? That, and at home? And do you have also efforts toward consortium funding and this sort of thing?
I want to talk. I am hopefully I'm answering your question. But I think based on the pilot project and the research that the steering committee first kind of did, they kind of highlighted three different areas where CAM has been using the findings of those research in our three pillars that we have continued to use to advocate and to do the work that we've been doing. And our three pillars are that came out of the research and the pilot project was collective learning and community building. And so far, CAM has been doing that through, our monthly CAM convenings. It's something that from the beginning, like Molly was saying, that in order for us to bring people together, we had to find a way. And that has been through our monthly CAM convenings to figure out what are people thinking about, what challenges are they facing in the sector, and what are the opportunities that we can use to help us continue to do the work that we're doing. And another area was communication and visibility. Now that we're connected through the CAM convening, how can we better communicate? How can we make sure that what is happening in Aroostook County can be visible here in Portland or in Lewiston, Maine, and vice versa? So CAM has been doing a lot of that through our newsletters and making sure that people submit to us things that they're working on. In terms of like advocacy and research, that's the third pillar. Like you said, we've been doing a little bit of advocacy in terms of like finding out what bills in regards to culture and arts that we can continue advocating for. We can send testimonies. We can continue to let people know that there is something, there's an advocacy, or there is a bill or a bond that affects us as the cultural sector that they are aware of. And how can we move gain momentum and move the needle so that those advocacy action can actually become a bill that is passed, a law that is passed that can help us. So yeah, we advocate and we're still learning on ways that how to continue to be better advocates as the Cultural Alliance of Maine.
That's great. I know that we had Cultural Advocacy Day. What was that, March 15th or so? And so that's a very important day for you, I'm sure, because those are all your people. So what do you do with like, so say I'm involved with the Bangor Band because Phil Edelman was on our show just before you. What do we do to get involved in an organization like CAM?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Like Ikhlas mentioned, we have these virtual convenings called CAM convenings, and we're also now moving into in-person gatherings, which we'll be announcing soon. But I think that's first and foremost just come together and be part of the conversations that we're having and ask questions and share your own story. I also encourage people to just reach out to us and give us a little heads up about what's on your horizon, what's something exciting that you're starting. We got a note from one community in Southern Maine that's just started an arts council or arts committee at their municipal level. And so we're going to be visiting them in the coming month and just learning about where they're at and seeing who we can connect them with so that they can benefit from understanding what's worked well or what hasn't worked well elsewhere. So that's a lot of it is, we want to be switchboard operators in a way and just, build connections between, the archive that's looking for community engagement, ideas and, the artist that's working with archival materials or, anything like that. And I would say the other piece is we're very eager to be part of, I guess you would call them just kind of roundtable conversations in different regions. It's, I think always shocking in Maine how often we all seem to know each other. And at the same time, it's also sometimes shocking how, somebody the next town over has been doing something for years that we've never had any idea about, or it's just never come across our line of vision. So We're really eager to just, get people around a table. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. To get people around a table who are, doing cultural work, broadly speaking, and just kind of share some ideas and share goals. Like, what do we want to see happen within this community in the next, months or years? I live in Hancock County, so we're starting a what we're calling a Hancock County culture coffee clatch or something like that. We ended up getting in touch around a certain request that we were making to the county commissioners, and just decided we should all just meet once a month and have coffee, on a Monday morning. And and that's taking a page from what they're doing in Portland at Creative Portland. They have, I think, like a first Monday morning kind of meetup there. So we're really just trying to cross-pollinate in a lot of ways, not only within towns or within one town in some cases, or neighboring towns, or between regions, just see what's working well. So we're only two people, of course. So what we're hoping is that we give organizations and people that are passionate about culture in their communities the feeling of being part of something bigger, so that they can feel empowered to start building, networks and alliances locally. I mean, there's so many that exist around the state right now. So we're just thinking about how we can link everybody together with one
That's
voice.
great, sort of like a dating app for cultural institutions. I think that's fantastic. Wow. So how can our listeners find out more about you? Where would they go to get more information about CAM and its wonderful efforts?
CulturalMaine.org.
CulturalMaine.org.
Facebook and Instagram as well. We're on there. I think it's at Cultural Maine, and then on Facebook, Cultural Alliance of Maine. Definitely subscribe to our newsletter. We send those out about twice a month. And we've recently redesigned that to be kind of a roundup of cultural news, from the library in Caribou that got, unanimous support from the city council to increase funding, to something that's opening new in Western Maine, to a new earmark grant that came through. We're just trying to uplift all of the good work that's happening. And, sometimes you spark serendipitous things that way.
That's wonderful, and it can all be found at, what is it,
CulturalMaine.org.
culturalmaine.org. Okay. Well, thank you both so very much. This has been a pleasure, and I look forward to working with you in many capacities in the future. Thank you so much for coming on. If our listeners would like to find out a little bit more about you, of course, they can go to your website or to weru.org. Thank you so very much. And have a
Thank you.
wonderful spring. May there be no more snow on your parade, and we will talk to you again soon, I hope.
Thank you.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. Today's calendar segment highlights recurring gatherings around our region. Saturday Stitch Social takes place the second and fourth Saturdays of each month from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. at Waterfall Arts, 256 High Street in Belfast. It's free. For more information and to RSVP, visit waterfallarts.org. Surrey Contra and Community Dance invites all ages to come and dance. On the second Saturday of each month, there is an open band at 6 p.m. and a dance from 7 to 10 p.m. at Surrey Elementary School, 754 North Bend Road in Surrey. For more information, call 207-385-7694 or visit deffa.org. Which Stitch? A Circle of Needles. Bring your handwork and work together in a circle of community support and conversation. Sundays from 1 to 4 at Art Waves MDI, 1345A State Highway 102, Bar Harbor. For more information, visit artwavesmdi.org. And finally, a life drawing class is held every Wednesday from 10 a.m. to noon at The Gatherings, 1208 Surrey Road, Surrey. For more information, call 207-374-7224 or visit www.surreygatherings.org.
For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the community calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line.
So Ariel, I just love the music that you composed as the theme for Creative Maine. I think it's fantastic. And I know that Thomas Edison said that genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your inspiration and your perspiration and how it all works out.
Well, funny enough, Thomas Edison's process, in a sense, is not actually that different from a lot of what I did, because most of his inventions famously were complete duds. And he took a patent out on everything, but a lot of his stuff isn't actually widely known. Some of them are straight up creepy, like those, weren't there like talking dolls or something? But the point was really just a lot of trial and error. And when he finally struck gold, he knew he had something special. And so I can say for me, I hadn't actually done a project like this before. So when you approached me about actually writing the music, there were a few parameters that I needed to set. And within that, had to find creative ways to reach my marks. So one of the things that I most needed to be clear about was, you know, knowing the theme of the show, what was the most important tone to strike with the music? Mm-hmm. What kind of story did you want to tell? What kind of vibe did you want it to have? Did you want it to be exciting? Did you want it to be thoughtful? Did you want it to have elements of a number of things? And so in approaching it, I said, okay, there's a very particular drive that I want to capture that tells the listener that they're about to hear something special and something exciting, something that impacts their lives potentially and their communities. So I said, okay, what sorts of elements in the music are going to make that possible? And I ended up doing a lot of experimenting back and forth with those things. But I knew a couple things up front. One of them was a lot of excitement is felt through rhythm. And I think that humans as a species really latch on to that. It's like one of the most fundamental parts of music. So the rhythm has to be driven and it has to sound exciting. And that was one of the first things that I started with, and after that was able to play with melody and counter melody, hopefully to good effect.
Well, yes, and the most interesting thing is that you play all of these things yourself.
Yes.
So how did that work?
So basically I started out with three lines, and I knew upfront, because I was going to be recording it myself and I was going to need to put all of the parts together and stack them on top of one another so it sounded like a full ensemble playing. I had to make it, a manageable size. So I started with three parts, all played on viola, and purposefully divided up the range so that one part might tend towards lower tones or rhythmic counterpoint, and one other part would tend towards a higher range. So it would sound a little bit more expansive and full. And then once I actually began the recording process, it was one of those things where it's like if you sit in a movie studio, for instance, with your headphones on, you have a click in the background, which is essentially just a metronome letting you know exactly where you are, making sure that that is what every part is based on. So I took a click, recorded myself three times, and then with an editing software, basically just stacked all of those parts on top of one another until it sounded like a full piece.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Well, I just want you to know that we think it's fabulous and unique, and I don't know anything else like it. You may, but I don't. And I think it is setting exactly the right tone for our show. So thank you so much, Ariel Chapman, and I hope to speak with you on here again soon.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you so much to my wonderful guests, Helen Daly, Philip Edelman, Ikhlas Ahmed, and Molly Cashwell. We had so much fun exploring community bands, FlossTube, and the Cultural Alliance of Maine today. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on WERU.org for another eclectic episode in 1 month. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.